You are listening to www.integralnaked.org.
Let's also remember that we want to circle back to two or so major exercises. We're going to talk about the gross body, subtle body, and causal body, so we don't want to forget to do that as well. And there's also the thing to keep in mind that can come in and out of the conversation as well, which is the pathological version of masculine and feminine at each of these three levels.
Yeah.
Because that's a very important aspect as well.
Okay.
So if we take any given individual and we just assume there's a density of being, in Ken's language, which is fantastic, we'll just use the three states, the mini model, and we'll say any individual, no matter what level their center of gravity of expression as a self are always at expressing causal, subtle, and gross expressions, whether they're conscious of it or not, etc. Now, each of those, as Ken would say, has a body associated with it, a gross body, subtle body, causal body, whatever you want to call them. Now, within those bodies, each of those bodies, you as an individual can have different center of gravity of masculine and feminine. So let me give you examples of that, because this could be useful. So, for instance, I work with a lot of gay and lesbian and so-called bisexual people who have no... Their gender is essentially irrelevant, so it's very easy to work with as opposed to people who are so identified with their gender as their sexual orientation. So let's take two gay men, and because I think it's easier to see it this way. But you could have two gay men who at the gross level, body, one of them really likes to be a bottom and one likes to be a top. You know what I mean? You know, one of them really likes to take it, take it up their ass or however they want to take it, and one of them really likes to give it. So at the gross level, one is identified more with receiving energetic vibrations, which is more of the feminine aspect of it, and one of them is more in pervading or penetrating, like consciousness pervades and penetrates. So at the gross level, they could have that identification. So when they go to bed, say, everyone likes to change it up, of course, but let's say that 80% of the time one goes, do me, and the other goes, I'm going to do you. I'm just making a kind of caricature out of this. And that, of course, can apply to heterosexual relationships or anything. Now, at the subtle level, that doesn't have to apply because the subtle body has its own identification. Now, at the subtle level, that's actually multiplicity of levels. We're simplifying it for this mini model, but there's like a mental plane, a pranic plane, an emotional plane, and so forth. So I'm just going to pick a kind of emotional mental body. I could refine it, but let's not for the moment to make a good example. It's all in the subtle domain. It's not the physical body. So they're done having sex in bed, and they get up, and now someone has to make a decision, like where to go to eat. It may be that the more feminine identified body, the one who's just on the bottom in ecstasy because they were so fucked so good, gets up and goes, it's 5 o'clock, let's go have a hamburger. Takes the, whole perspective, what are the possibilities, what time is it, where are we going, there, which is a masculine capacity because the feminine is low. And the person who was the masculine top, the physical top, might now flow in the feminine domain of emotions, like, wow, that sounds great. Or, no, I don't really feel like a hamburger. And then the masculine person will go like, well, what do you want? I don't know. And the masculine, well, Chinese?
No.
Mexican?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to Mexican. Quick, get on your coat. It's closing in half an hour. So the person with the gross masculine identity might have a subtle feminine identity, gross masculine, subtle feminine. Then, in meditation, which we'll just say it's a high subtle form of meditation as an example, the person who is just identifying with making the decision, masculine mental, and the bottom, feminine physical, now toward the causal or the high subtle, might really get into just resting in the witness, letting everything arise and fall, witnessing it. And that may be what they tend to do in meditation as an actual effective practice of meditation. Whereas the person who is the physical top, masculine, subtle body, feminine, oh, sounds great, might also be a meditative or high, subtle, low, causal feminine, and open, feel light pouring down in their body, and feel light, and their body
and
actually
love
dissolves, and that light is love. So they're feeling there is that everything is light, is love, and their partner next to them is everything is empty. And then when they come out of that, the one makes a decision who's at the subtle masculine, while the subtle feminine has all these possible options all mixed together. And then when it comes time to fuck, the one who is just all over is like, lay down. Because they're identified with the... You understand? So
yeah.
And that's true about heterosexuals, too, which causes a lot of confusion, because someone could want someone in bed one way, but in everyday life another way. And then when they go to a spiritual teacher or a spiritual practice, it's another thing. Because depending on what... If the spiritual practice only deals with the high, subtle, low causal, it will address that. And it'll leave the person bereft of skill at the decision-making level, at the emotional level, at the sexual level, and at the physical level. And the other way around, too. You could just deal with someone's physical needs and not touch their meditative capacities or their emotional exchange. So if you look at some famous spiritual teachers, I probably shouldn't name names, but you can see that some of them are like everything is consciousness, and they don't even deal with things like the nitty-gritty of relationships and chocolate and drinking and how to have an eloquent argument and, you know, just the stuff of life, because they're not identified enough with the feminine. It's all just arising, you know, it's all just happening out there or something. And other spiritual teachers, they're heavily identified with the nitty gritty of things, and they forget to emphasize the never changing aspect of consciousness.
Now, they same experience it themselves.
Exactly. Now, artists are the same way, obviously. Now, your art is being transmitted in all of these levels simultaneously. So it's important to understand whether you're embodying the more masculine or feminine expression. And as states, you can embody both. Some will be more comfortable for you than others, but you can certainly embody the full spectrum, which you sometimes need. So when I'm doing my gig, I use my body, even with you, a lot to try to express things in a more energetic fashion. But that doesn't preclude me necessarily from also cognitively saying things in a clearer way. Some people it does. Some people are really good at one and not the other, and that's fine. They just have to know their limits and invite other people to help flesh it out. But anyways, I just wanted to bring up that an individual at different, in their different bodies or simultaneous states, could have masculine or feminine identification that is different at each level of their state body, grows subtle and causal. And that will affect how they move through the levels or stages as they grow, because they'll tend to emphasize, given their predisposition, one aspect of each as they grow, because these stages are, it's more complicated, of course, but they're related to the states in certain ways that we can get into. But those predispositions in the states will cascade into the stage development, and you have to be careful that they don't ship off as a sub-personality. It's just preference.
Right, which often can happen because there's a conflict between the masculine and feminine sides of themselves. See, not everybody makes a fluid transition between them either. I mean, it can be very confusing to be top here, bottom there, top here,
right.
Bottom there. You kind of whiplash. And then, of course, it's a four-quadrant thing, so culture has a lot to say about what you're allowed to be or what you're not allowed to be. So corporate board CEO guy who's in charge of all this thing gets off work and goes over to dominatrix and have her, you know, whip the snot out of him because he's got to be a bottom in certain circumstances. Now, he doesn't know quite what to make of that, nor does his wife, the Great Dane that he's married to. It's all very confusing. A lot of that has to do with culture, what it's allowed, what isn't allowed. So that these are all...
And actually, that's a good point, that artistically and in other ways, this opens a whole other can of worms we might not want to get into now, but the reason artists tend to be extreme in certain ways is because they're dealing with these energies. Let me use the example Ken just used and expand it from there. If you're in your masculine all day, executive, making decisions, whether you're a man or a woman, then just for your own sense of health, you need to play the other side of flowing. The example I use is like the masculine is the banks of a river and the feminine is the flow of the river, which we both are. You're both. Now, if you're playing the banks of the river all day, you do this, you do this, this project should go this way, here's the schedule, here's the schedule, here's the schedule. Nobody's all masculine. We're all both. So they need to then, like, they go home, you know, after a day or a week, and they're pathologically masculinized, and they just need, like Ken was saying, you know, to go to a dominatrix. And the people who go to dominatrix are usually very masculine people.
And very high power.
Very.
It should be really amazing.
And so they could go, like, just tell me what to do, and it's a pleasure then to flow. They could just flow. They don't have to make any decisions. They could flow, and that provides a kind of balance, a healing for being the master.
As is a 3-martini lunch.
Through anything that
gets them into the flow. Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing is, we understand that for business. We tend not to understand that in pure subtle energy forms. So people like performers or politicians who are running a lot of energy through their body, and all of you, if you do performance, you know there's a difference between just working hard, like digging a ditch, and running that kind of energy through your body and performing. It's a completely different form of exhaustion or form of being battered. They tend to get into drugs and sex in extreme ways in order to, it's like a medicine for what they put their subtle body through. Drugs are subtle body effectors in general. I mean, you could take them for physical effects also, but what they really are good at is like, whoa, you know, it just shifts the whole flow of energy. So people use that as kind of a medicine. Now, if you don't consciously use that as a medicine in a healthy way, sometimes it's illegal to, but if you just don't know it, it becomes pathological. So it's the difference, for instance, to use your example, Ken, of a man who's a high-powered executive and just consciously knows, because he's gone through the mini-map, and he knows, I've been in my masculine all day in these domains, I need to come back. He goes to his wife and he goes, you know, hey, baby, for the next hour, beat me. You know, whatever. Time up, and she's like, sure, and they play that, and then it's done, and they can do whatever they want. If he doesn't do that, he becomes fetishistic about it. He develops, it's guilty. Why do I have these feelings? Why am I fantasizing about women? If my daddy knew what I was thinking, and so they go out and just pace my hey, dress in leather. And then, you know what I mean? It becomes a pathological fetish rather than something like anyone would enjoy at times. Well, the same thing is true in the domains of drugs and sex in art, that it becomes a fetish unless you healthfully embrace whatever you need to do to compensate for the extreme use of your subtle body. I mean, there's a reason for it, and you could actually use the whole mini model and graph that out and show why some artists choose heroin and anal sex and other artists choose speed and thievery, you know, as ways of compensating for their excessive exercise without compensation.
Can I interject? I'm fascinated by that point in particular too, because in my experience and in many other artists' experience that I know of, I had major issues with drugs, alcohol, and all variety of physical stimulus until I started meditating and doing yoga. And they literally, I thought I was an alcoholic, I thought I was a drug addict, went through treatment twice, and when I took up those practices, dropped away and dissolved.
Right.
In a manner that I was suspicious of for years. I always thought, this is too good to be true. This is going to come back. And, well, it's been 10 years. And it has never come back. And I still have little echoes of it in terms of, like, you know, oral fetishes or things like that, but nothing that has been. So do you see that correlation oftentimes? I mean,
absolutely. Well, that's the difference between a stage and a state, though. Being able to use drugs or sex as a temporary state change to balance yourself out is very different than the consistent use of a practice, which changes your stage.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly if artists did yoga, as a very general term, a consistent practice, and did the right one for themselves, they would be able to eliminate a lot of the temporary state changes they need to compensate.
Mm-hmm.
But very few people, this is where the stage thing comes in, very few artists are personally stage developed enough, you are, but few are, to be willing to take up a consistent practice other than the ones that they already do. So most artists will get out there and play and they'll practice their instrument or their painting or their dance or whatever, they'll do that. But to add to that consistent real yoga practice or real meditative practice and so forth, those who could do it, absolutely. I mean, of course, that's what it's for, to you learn how to channel energies through your body, because real good meditation opens you to these huge energies. So they had to evolve the bodily, subtle concomitant practice to that. So these yogis would find, well, and so then they have to do asanas and breathing and things, just like a good performer does. Good performers are yogis, really good ones. You know, I mean, however you want to cut it, Mick Jagger, if he's still going at his age, is a yogi. He might not be consciously doing asanas, but his body, as you can see, quite open to channeling energy. Someone who's not, they go home and they're just using way too many drugs to sustain it till 60 years old. He went through a drug phase, obviously, like most artists too, but if you could channel it, either because you're born with that capacity, like Steve Tyler or Mick Jagger or someone, or because you develop it, like yourself, absolutely, practices evolve the stage, allow the stage change. As Ken was saying earlier, the key is repeated states create change of stage over time. And you could repeat those states in an exogenous way, like through drugs, which just repeats you using the drugs. Or you could repeat those states endogenously, self-created through yoga or something. And if you repeat a state endogenously, you become more able to open to the pre-existence of that state and therefore relax as it over time. It becomes your stage. So doing yoga or whatever repeatedly allows you to channel energy as your center of gravity, not as a remedial temporary state change.
Right. So repeated state changes change stages, but I could have changed my state for the rest of my life through using drugs and alcohol stuff and not change stages.
No, repeated endogenous.
Endogenous.
Mm-hmm. It has to be endogenous. It's the only thing that shakes loose your identification with a structure. If a drug is relaxing the problem, it's relaxing the disidentification process too. Is you're not constantly metabolizing that which you need to in order to let go of the identification. That's really why psychedelics don't have the types of effects that they're supposed to have. And they can help people shake out of it, but most of the transformative after effects that come from psychedelics are the changes set in motion when people are off the drug. And the repercussion of that, they re-look at their worldview in different ways.
It would be useful to bring up this weekend too, because there's a lot of confusion in our community and a romanticized notion that changing the state with drugs, you know, will induce these
changes of states. Okay, that's what they induce. Changes of states. And they do.
People don't think they're changing stages when they're altering their state.
Very, very rare. Very, very rare. And like I say, the types of things that happen during the state change that are effective are often carryovers. The person learns to reinterpret something on a state. And that reinterpretation stays with them, and therefore it starts having a conscious effect.
Right.
And that's what is transformative in the long run.
Yeah.
So there are little bits of things that come through. They're very, very small, not nearly as much as what people think. And we know this. We have way too much experience with these kinds of things to see any really effective stuff happen. No. And it's just for the reason David said. It's exogenous or endogenous. And all that plays into it. Even the early, even Kim Leary and crew, very early on, started saying that that what you get in psilocybin and LSD and stuff like that is dependent upon not just the drug but set and setting. And that's another way of saying I, we, and it are involved in the actual effect that the drug has. And under those circumstances, and then Stan Groff is starting to say that LSD is basically a non-specific amplifier of experience. And all of those are ways to say it's not just the drug itself, and that's not just what's happening. It's all these other factors that are going into it. But you really have to be careful when it comes to art and the championing of drug states, because mostly drug states just give you drug states, and that's great. It's not that it's bad or it's wrong. People can use it, as you're saying, as a mode of expression. Alex Gray uses drugs the way some people use a piano or a violin. I mean, they're expressions of his understanding. But it's definitely something worth bringing up, because that has to be, at the very least, the problem with the states side of the equation. Remember, both stages and states have their drawbacks. The main problem with states is, unless you have a stage conception, no permanent enduring growth tends to occur. And so people get into states and they champion them because they want that instant gratification, immediate switch. That's it. I'm plugged into it. Don't tell me I have to meditate for 2 and 3 and 5 years. I don't want to talk about it. So they take themselves out of long-term growth. They take themselves out of the evolutionary game. That's tragic. So I don't mind people doing it as long as they aren't kidding themselves about what is actually happening. And a tour of states is just that. A tour of states can be enormously beneficial for all sorts of reasons. Some drugs have a modest amount of carryover. Ecstasy is therapeutically. MDMA has a fair amount of carryover. The insights you get on that drug can be used to help stay in touch with certain emotions. that's a far cry from saying that it's causing transformation. And if you take yourself out of the transformation game, it's cute for a year or two, but 30 years down the line, you will really regret what you've done with your consciousness. It's just very sad at that point. A judicious use of both, great.
Yeah. There's a masculine and a feminizing influence of drugs, too, to bring it back to what we started off. Is that if you're using a drug and it repeatedly induces a state of identification with light, you tend to be feminized. It tends to bleed through into other domains of your being, and you tend to kind of just... Yeah, flow, cool, right, yeah.
Vibe, yeah.
And if you use a drug that tends to pop you into the witness, like everything's happening but you're not flowing in it, it tends to make you more non-participatory.
Ketamine.
Yeah, ketamine's a great one. So those masculine people prefer ketamine, feminine people prefer the light-inducing drugs, but they go the other way, too.
For the same reason dominatrix.
Exactly.
Yes.
So... Yeah, and each drug, not only drugs, but people, places, music. As you know, for inspiration, another way to talk about transmission is inspiration. Just like each of us as performers can transmit a state that repeatedly could help someone loosen to achieve a state, a stage, we can also receive inspiration, which is subtle vibratory reinforcement of both states and hopefully eventually stages by going to a certain place or holy sites which have been imbued with subtle influence. But drugs have the same thing. For instance, you know, every drug tradition, if you look over thousands of years, the old drugs, you know, like opiates, alcohol, tobacco, marijuana, ayahuasca, they have an associated subtle body with it. You don't... Where you go on ayahuasca isn't the same place you go on opiates, but they're all populated by the same kind of beings and the same kind of energy. And so you keep revisiting these states. It's like revisiting Hawaii or going to Paris. It could be inspiring in a state way. It could give you a state that inspires you. And so artists have always have used inspiration, whether in the form of going to places or listening to music that brings you to another state change or using drugs. So as an artist, then, the inspiration is using the subtle state range, and also the transmission is using the subtle state range.
Let's remember that, you know, we want to circle back to two or so major exercises. We're going to talk about the gross body, subtle body, and causal body, so we don't want to forget to do that as well. And there's also the thing, keep in mind, that can come in and out of the conversation as well, which is the pathological version of masculine and feminine at each of these three levels.
Yeah.
Because that's a very important aspect as well. And part of the difficulty when you live in a culture that doesn't really allow a discussion of authentic masculine and feminine, it's become politicized in all sorts of kind of brutal ways, is that just like the fetish object that we talked about earlier, masculine and feminine forms come out in these very, very whacked kind of forms. And so there are people that are on very, very tenuous or even antagonistic relationship with their own masculine and feminine tendencies. We've actually managed to get into a culture that really despises both authentic masculine and feminine components. So part of what tends to happen is that most of what goes for masculine in this culture is pathological masculine. That's what people attend. And most of what's called feminine is really a desiccated area of masculinized pathological feminine. And so people have a great, or it's an exaggerated in the other direction, it's the 50s housewife. So people have a very hard time coming to rest in their own native dispositions that express these in healthy ways. It strikes me that one of the things, certainly not only in your own relationships, personal relationships, and so on, but in any sort of performing art, is to actually be able to manifest, transmit, communicate a healthy masculine, feminine energy is also something to be very important in terms of a transmission of these ideas. And it gives people a chance to resonate in an authentic way with these modes that really aren't allowed anyplace else. Art has one great thing going for it, which is that you're given a certain amount of leeway. We used to go to like performance art, and it's like a person starts across the stage, you know, and they took like a half hour to crawl across the stage, and when they turn around and head back, that's when I leave. you can do something radical and unallowed anyplace else, which is transmit healthy sexual energy. So that's also something sort of might circle back into the conversation too as well.
One of the great things in using a mini model, it helps show individuals where they're not elaborating or offering or doing art or teaching.
Right.
So where in the states are they lacking? Where in the levels are they not addressing? But also in the masculine and feminine, it's such an underlying... There are some people, teachers, who actually think that sitting up there and talking about it and then transmitting the causal is satsang or something, is teaching. And it is. And the highly masculinized version.
Yeah.
And then they wonder, why are relationships this way? Why are the women this way? And they're like, Jesus. But if they can just look at all these, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing this, they could either have somebody come in and do it or realize this is only for a certain kind of person.
And I think that's important. There's been a lot of misunderstanding about what integral actually means. And it doesn't mean that you have to sort of yourself master every single thing and be comprehensive in every single thing. So let's say that you are specifically a spiritual teacher. And that means that to some extent you are trying to teach people to awaken to the full spectrum of awareness and continue to grow through your own stages as high as possible. It's not necessary in order to be integral that you master every single component of this yourself. I mean, any sort of sequence that we go through, you don't, it's like you can go through oral, anal, and genital development. To pass to the oral stage, you don't have to be a great French chef. It's not required. All you have to do is basically have a certain competence, and at the very least, you don't want to be repressing those components. So one of the things that happens when you use an integral model is you can actually look at it and say, okay, here I am, I'm a spiritual teacher. Okay, guess what? I'm doing causal masculine. I'm doing Vipassana. That's all I'm really good at. Now, I can do one of two things. I can myself spend years learning these other components that I'm not emphasizing. Or I can bring in other teachers. I can look at my own students and say, this is what I'm really good at. And if you need this, come to me. And I will really, really, really work with you on this. And we call it freeing a practice by limiting it. In other words, by actually showing people where they excel, not only can they concentrate on it, they can stop pretending that the practice they're doing is going to take care of all these other things. Mm. Because when it doesn't, and it won't, the students get pissed. They get hurt, they get angry, right or so. And then you've got a mess on your hand. Because the teacher, working from this one little part of the matrix, says, when they should be dealing with all these other areas, the teacher says, intensify your efforts. So it drives everybody nuts, and the teachers eventually get kind of worn down by this. The students get very, very worn down by it. So integral doesn't mean, it's very hard to create an integral practitioner in the sense of somebody who masters all these areas. But it's very easy to create an integral team with people who do work with each of these areas in very specific ways. And that's what we're really kind of looking for as well, hopefully, in terms of creating two things. Integrally informed teachers, which means you are informed about this whole model, even though you yourself don't practice all these, nor would you be expected to. But if you know about it, then you're integrally informed. And then you can create a support team or other teachers who are working with these other areas. That becomes very, very important. And I think that's going to be what we're going to increasingly see in terms of future spiritual communities and integral transformative practice. Because realistically speaking, if you go to a teacher, whether it's mathematics or physics or language or playing a piano or raja, one person isn't going to be an Olympic champion in all of those. I mean, you really go to specialists, and it's nothing the matter with being a specialist. That doesn't mean you're not integral. You mean integrally informed specialists. And that's what we do. So we teach integrally informed practitioners. And then if you're actually working with a certain area, then you have an integral, a comprehensive team, so to speak, each of whom is an integrally informed specialist on that team. And unfortunately, what's happening again is that spiritual teachers who are sort of covering one aspect of the aqual matrix try to make that cover other bases, doesn't cover it very well. When these other things start to fall apart, they ask you to intensify the effort. All that's caused an enormous amount of fallout. It's really a problem. So at the very least, one of the things we want to start doing, Dave and I and a couple others actually talking about what we're calling a mini model SWAT team. And so what we really want to do is we have several spiritual teachers that really are saying, okay, you know what? I'm really good at this. I'm leaving out stuff over here. I'm starting to get to the point where I realize there's other stuff over here and I'm not covering it. Therefore, what's the minimal I need to be integrally informed? And that's going to, in other words, free their practice by limiting. And so they actually go in and say, here we are, we're doing 7 days of Vipassana. Guess what? That's masculine causal. That's what we're doing. And it's leading out this, and this, and this, and this, and this. And so somebody comes in, and it could be that one of the reasons they're not making progress in masculine causal witnessing is that they have all these fixations or stick points or problems at all these in the subtle body, the gross body, or even the causal feminine. So somebody can come in and say, okay, you really need to pay attention to over here. And, oh, the, you know, Susie over there specializes in that. Go see Susie. And then, you know, come back to you in a bit. That's a much saner way to deal with these things. And it's not a put down on anybody. Nobody specializes in the whole shebang. Nobody. It's not personal life. That theoretically can, or practically can do that.
And to some extent, this may translate to integral art. If you wanted to do integral art and cover, so to speak, all the levels of the lines and so forth, you might not be able to do it on your own. You may have highly developed capacities in certain domains, but other people have them in other domains, and together. So as a team, how do you do art? Now, if you're a one-man show, you just have to face your limits and do your best and realize you are appealing to the, you know, subtle feminine of green people, you know, something like that. But you could easily invite people. Great rock bands are great because the different members occupy different places in the aqual quadrants and lines and levels and so forth. And there's the quiet one, the joyous one, the deep one. You know what I mean? And it resonates large groups, really. That's like the Spice Girls, you know, all the spices and stuff. But you could do a aqual version of the Spice Girls if you wanted to. So you could do integral art. You could have somebody who's really good at, like, holding the causal realm, but they're shitty at dancing. You know, and then you can have someone who's really good at moving sexual energy, but just alone, the whole place would come into just the grunt fest. So how do you then weave those together in a performance art or visual art or so forth so that you cover as many of the bases as you want?
So that's a good intro right there. We're going to do some more exercises. We're going to do two or so gross, subtle, and causal, and variations on those as we come on.
Okay. Well, let's start.
You are listening to www.integralnaked.org.